Katie averted her attention to the nearest distraction, which was unfortunately the army of dildos. She picked up one that was made of textured glass. It had icicle swirls running up its shaft. What do they call this one, she wondered? The Anna or Elsa model? And why do they give the damn things names? And if lesbians don't like dicks, why shove these freakish decoys into themselves and one another? And the balls, why? Katie set the icicle dildo back down in its place. Maybe this was too much too fast. She went to the register with the sex book and set it on the counter. Are you all set? Elizabeth asked from where she was assisting the squirter with a device that looked to Katie like a cattle prod.
Yes, just this.
Katie took out her credit card as Elizabeth came around the counter to ring her up.
And this.
Katie bolted back to the vibrator table, grabbed a hot pink gadget that was only slightly embarrassing, and not at all like something she could whip a smoothie in.
The boss lady, Elizabeth said. That's a great choice. It's firm, yet pliant, with a tilted head for G-spot stimulation. Then it even has a booster button.
Unsold, Katie said,
louder than she'd intended.
I mean, you don't have to sell me. I'll take it.
Okay.
Elizabeth stepped around the counter. But that's the floor model. I have to get it for you from the back. She disappeared, and Katie stared at her phone to avoid seeing anything or anyone else.
You look like a boss lady in that fancy business suit of yours, the corseted squirter said.
She snapped a whip against the floor.
Don't forget the batteries.
Katie removed her purchases from their bright blue shopping bag, then tore the bag to bright blue shreds and shoved them into the recycling. She uncorked a bottle of red wine, brought a glass to the living room, and sat across from her new book and vibrator. Where to begin? She slid the boss lady out of its black box, inserted its batteries, and switched it on. She watched it do its thing, shaking in the palm of her hand, then thrusting in the palm of her hand, then shaking and thrusting in the palm of her hand. Katie switched off the boss lady and set it upon the coffee table beside her wine glass, so the two of them were standing at odds like a deviant still life. She reached for the book. There was more nudity in its pages than she'd realized at the store, which she guessed was to be expected in a sex how-to, but these bodies looked a little too real. Had this been published before Photoshop was invented? She flipped some more until she stumbled upon the words lesbian fantasy. She took a sip of wine. 80% of straight women have had lesbian fantasies. She took another sip of wine and read on, hoping to get some more numbers. Specifically, of that 80%, how many acted on the fantasy? And from that group, how many had given gay sex hardly any mind at all before encountering this one single lesbian? Katie had never been a fantasizer of any kind. She was more of a planner, a doer. She was a pleaser of others, not one for exploring self-pleasure, or whatever the heck Elizabeth from Babeland called it. But Cassidy was hot, and the only other women Katie ever thought of as hot were the ones she wanted to be. Not do, be. It only confused her further that Cassidy was hot like a guy was hot. She'd felt almost male to Katie when she was kissing her. Katie's doorbell rang, and she instinctively grabbed the vibrator from the table and shoved it under the couch. Someone had probably pressed the wrong bell. It happened all the time, but she still slid the book beneath the couch's cushion. Then her phone dinged. A text from Cassidy. Hey, are you home? I'm at your door. What the hell? Katie ran to check herself in the mirror. She was in pajama bottoms and a t-shirt. No bra. Her hair was in a ponytail. The doorbell rang again. Oh, fuck it. She buzzed Cassidy in and made sure the boss lady's hot pink exterior wasn't visible from any angle. She opened the door and waited. The sight of Cassidy climbing up her stairs, wearing an overcoat and carrying a briefcase, made her stomach do a flip.
"I know this is weird, me showing up like this."
Cassidy entered and closed the door behind her.
"I was in a cab and about to text you, but then I just told the driver to take me here instead. I don't know why. I just really wanted to see you."
"So you really were stuck at work," Katie said.
"Of course. What did you think?"
Cassidy set down her briefcase and shook off her coat. She seemed uncharacteristically frazzled.
"You said earlier that you wanted to talk?"
"I did want to talk," Katie said. "I do."
"Can we sit?"
Cassidy gestured toward the couch. Katie remained in place, standing awkwardly in front of the door. She didn't want Cassidy to sit down, not only because she feared her foot would accidentally brush up against the vibrator Katie had stashed there.
"I haven't been able to stop thinking about you," Katie said.
The roiling energy Cassidy had brought into the apartment went still.
"Is that a good thing or a bad thing?"
Katie wasn't sure if it was good or bad, but it was undeniable. Cassidy took a step closer. Katie leaned her back against the door. She waited for Cassidy to kiss her, but Cassidy didn't. She wouldn't. She would have left them suspended in midair with an inch between their lips forever if Katie hadn't reached for Cassidy and pulled her in. That was the only green light Cassidy seemed to need to take over from there. All that nervous energy she'd arrived with came pouring out of her then. It wasn't nerves, Katie realized. It was wanting. It was need. Cassidy steered them into Katie's bedroom, onto the bed.
"I don't know what I'm doing," Katie said.
"I am totally okay with that."
Cassidy slid Katie's t-shirt up and off. Her mouth made its way down Katie's neck, across her chest. Katie closed her eyes and let herself get lost.
Chapter 12. As a rule, Cassidy never cuddled after sex. It gave girls the wrong idea to hold them longer than necessary. It made them get attached. She reminded herself of this while holding Katie, grazing her fingers up and down her arm, punched drunk on the smell of her hair. They were lying in the dark, but with street lamp light coming in from the window on one side and living room light coming in from the open door on the other, Cassidy could make out the entire space. Katie's bedroom was small, seemingly unloved, with a hodgepodge of IKEA furniture, but it was comfortable. These rough, big-box store sheets enveloped the two of them in a warm cocoon, and the pedestrian chatter and noisy car horns from outside only added to the feeling that they were hidden away someplace softer and more secure than the outer world. If Cassidy wasn't careful, she might doze off. It was time to go, well past midnight, and Katie had been asleep now for almost half an hour. Cassidy eyed the rumpled mound of her suit on the floor beside the bed. Her shoes she'd kicked off by the dresser. God only knew where her socks were. Carefully, she slid her arm out from under Katie, filling the empty space with a pillow, but she assumed Katie would still wake up while she was getting dressed.
"Katie," she whispered as she buttoned her shirt.
Cassidy had to go. They both had work early in the morning. Spending the night was not an option.
"I'm leaving,"
she tried again while buckling her belt. Did it matter if she said goodbye? Would Katie be upset by waking up and finding her gone? Cassidy didn't leave notes for girls to wake up to. Maybe she'd send a text a day or two later, but usually not even that. It was better to keep their expectations low right off the bat. But Cassidy was having trouble treating Katie like any other girl. Shoes tied, good to go, Cassidy noticed an envelope on Katie's dresser, some pre-sorted piece of junk mail from Time Warner. Not far off was a ballpoint pen. Cassidy scribbled a quick note on the back of the envelope.
Sweet dreams. Talk to you tomorrow. See.
And left it on Katie's nightstand.
No one could ever know about this.
The next day, Cassidy was a rocket, propelling herself through work with a singular purpose, to get back to Katie. With her suit jacket hung on the back of her chair, dress shirt sleeves rolled up to her elbows, an outside observer might have thought she'd snorted a line of coke for breakfast, the way she ricocheted from office to conference room to office as the head lawyer on a new deal. At a pit stop at the printer, she encountered her nemesis.
Whoa, where's the fire?
Hamlin was dunking his damn Lipton tea bag in his glass mug, on his way from the office kitchen back to his desk.
Don't you know the story about the tortoise and the hare? Slow and steady wins the race.
Drink coffee, Cassidy wanted to say to him.
Did you get my email about that issue with Deutsche?
Hamlin asked, still dunking.
I did, Cassidy said, and I emailed you back. Oh, you did? Great. What did you write back?
Cassidy homed in on the collar pin propping up Hamlin's tie knot. You look like a wimpy version of Gordon Gekko, she wanted to say.
I'm kind of in the middle of something here.
Cassidy wrested her document from the printer and stepped past him. No, not even Hamlin could bring her down today.
Maybe you can just go read the email, she said.
Back at her desk, Cassidy kept her cell phone out where she could see it, as she marked up her document, jotting notes, drawing arrows, crossing out redundant words, and slashing erroneous commas. Every text Katie sent her was fuel. Every text she returned was oxygen. The sex last night had been good, even better than Cassidy had expected, though it was hard to say why. Cassidy had done all the doing, of course, so what made it any different from all the other times with countless other women? Cassidy reflected on this while perusing an addendum to her document. It must have been how much she wanted it, how she'd been trying to fight it. Plus, their chemistry was undeniable. Cassidy had felt that right away, and it had proved true, even with Katie's tentativeness once they really got rolling. That split second when Katie seemed to almost panic. No, not panic, but stiffen. Cassidy signed off on the addendum. The way she'd had to ease Katie into it, just her touch, careful not to overwhelm her with anything unexpected, had only turned Cassidy on more. And then how Katie had opened up to her. Reimagining it now made Cassidy frantic. If she couldn't see Katie again tonight, she might spontaneously combust. But as the hours ticked by, their plans for dinner had to be pushed back to plans for drinks. And then plans for drinks were foiled by a last-minute client request. Of all the nights to get stuck working late, she texted Katie at 10 p.m. Why? By the time Cassidy rustled on her overcoat and headed for the elevator, Katie had already gone to bed, and she was too exhausted by her own disappointment to even swing by the Met, and that was really saying something. There were few ailments Metropolis couldn't soothe. As she exited her office building, she checked her phone one last time to make sure Katie hadn't miraculously woken up and texted a booty call. She had missed a text, but it was from Becky. Where are you at? Haven't seen you since I made $50 off your makeout sesh at the barbecue. Cassidy wrote back, just out of work, not making it to Met tonight. It's dead tonight anyways, Becky wrote. Come to my place, I'll cook you dinner. Cassidy checked her watch and wrote back, it's midnight. A midnight snack then. Thanks, but I'm gonna head home. Cassidy looked up and down the street for a taxi. Come on! Becky wrote. I miss her pretty boy face. I'll make you my special grilled cheese. Just went to Murray's this afternoon. Chef Becky's grilled cheese was no joke, A week's worth of fat and calories in one sitting, but well worth it.
I'm coming, Cassidy wrote back.
You will be when you get a load of my Gruyere. Don't make me change my mind. Cassidy found a cab and climbed in. She hadn't been to Becky's in a while. Back in the day, her apartment had been a constant. Their whole crew would get wasted at the Met, pick up girls, bring them around the block in a wild parade to Becky's. Becky would cook, games would be played, spin the bottle, strip Street Fighter, and sometimes a threesome or foursome or fivesome, sixsome or sevensome would ensue. The best nights, though, the ones that really stood out in Cassidy's memory, were when it was just the two of them hanging out, having a late-night food fest, passing the time like it would last forever. It was a blast when Gina moved to town and started dating Becky, until they broke up. Then everything got messed up. Cassidy had decided that Gina needed her more than Becky did, because Gina was the more broken one, and Becky understood that. But sometimes Cassidy missed how easy their friendship used to be, before all the complications. Cassidy's taxi passed the Met just before turning the corner onto Becky's block, and she couldn't help but glance to see who might be out front. It was a reflex. No matter what time of day it was, it could be 8 in the morning. If Cassidy passed the Met, her head turned. She wasn't looking for a familiar face. It was more just what people did when they happened upon their home en route to someplace else. And that's basically what the Met was to Cassidy, a second home. Out of the car and through the front gate, Cassidy pressed the worn, familiar doorbell on Becky's building and waited to be buzzed in. She climbed the 3 flights up, those same rickety wooden stairs with the same loose step that always scared her half to death, and found the apartment door open. Becky was already grating a brick of cheese into a snowy pile when she stepped inside.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Becky blew her a kiss.
Make yourself at home.
Becky's apartment was mostly kitchen, pots and pans hanging from the ceiling, towering stacks of giant mixing bowls, industrial shelves packed with menacing appliances, and an oven she had special ordered. Since her brief brush with fame, the place was also littered with promotional items from her season on Knife Fight. Cassidy shrugged off her coat and approached the life-size cardboard cutout of herself that Becky had displayed in the living room. In the cutout, she was wearing a white, blood-smeared apron and a navy blue bandana around her head. She was standing with 1 foot in front of the other, one arm pointing out and the other raised alongside her head, ready to throw a giant chef's knife. Cassidy gave it a tap on the forehead.
Still have your own doppelganger as your roommate, I see.
I'm thinking of sending her on the road to promote the new restaurant. Becky continued to grate.
Sort of like a Flat Stanley meets Amelie's Gnome meets Guy Fieri. How do you feel about me adding prosciutto to this?
Go crazy. Cassidy untied her Oxfords and kicked them off.
Want a drink?
I do if this is an intervention, Cassidy said.
Help yourself to the good scotch.
Becky pointed with her knife toward her bar cart.
Damn it, I knew this sandwich was going to cost me.
Cassidy trudged over to the cart to pour herself a glass of something strong. Let me guess, you want to talk to me about Katie?
I like Katie, Becky said. I'm a big fan, in fact. She's our age. She's not married to a man. She's beautiful, smart.
She's not that straight, Cassidy interjected.
Smart. I said smart. You were going to say straight next.
Drink in hand, Cassidy plopped down on the couch across from cardboard Becky. Becky's pile of grated cheese was now a small mountain.
What I was going to say next was sweet. And anyway, I saw her kissing you. I'm not buying it that she's all that straight.
Gina doesn't like her, Cassidy said.
Gina's only trying to protect you.
She can see how much you like this girl, and she doesn't want you to get hurt. Personally, I think Katie can be good for you.
Becky sliced her way through a thick loaf of Pullman bread.
I've known you for what, 7 years now?
That can't be right. Cassidy lay horizontally across the couch, resting her drink on her stomach.
It is right.
Becky slapped a hunk of butter on one of the slices of bread.
You were just out of NYU when we met. You hadn't even started law school. Now you're 30. I turn 30 next year. You, me, and Dahlia, now we're like the goddamn elders. Of our original group, have you not noticed that we're the only three left? Everyone else either aged out, coupled off, or got sober.
Is this supposed to make me want to kill myself? Cassidy said. If so, you're doing a great job. Becky swirled some olive oil around her frying pan.
I'm just making the point that for years I've watched you fuck around with every piece of tail that stepped into that bar. I've seen girls throw drinks in your face, throw glasses at the wall beside your head, throw themselves at me just to spite you. And you just continue on all la-di-da, barely flinching. For a while there, I was convinced you were actually a sociopath.
Where are you going with this, Chef?
Becky covered her sizzling sandwich and took a step back from the stove.
Even the girls you dated for a few months, it was obvious it wouldn't last. And the ones you could have had something real with, you never gave them the time of day. But Katie's different. I could see it on the way you look at her.
Oh, give me a goddamn break.
Go ahead. Pretend you're playing it cool. Your act doesn't work on me.
Becky flipped her sandwich and recovered the pan.
You forget that I know what's going on below the facade. I know how soft you are beneath there.
Okay, you know what? Cassidy sat up. Just because I cried that one time he did shrooms doesn't mean you can see into my soul.
Ha! I'd forgotten about that. But you're wrong. I did see into your soul that day.
Becky slid the sandwich out of the pan onto her cutting board. She sliced it in half with a giant knife.
We're not so different, you and me. Sure, you're taller, thinner, richer, and more handsome, but you're just as messed up on the inside as I am. And deep down, you know that no matter how hard you work out, how healthy you eat, how expensive your skincare regimen is, no amount of upkeep is stopping time.
Becky slid both halves of the sandwich onto a plate.
I think it's time for both of us to start thinking about the future.
Is this seriously why you lured me over tonight? Cassidy said.
Becky walked the plate over to Cassidy and set it down on the table in front of her.
Eat these carbs. I promise they'll make you feel better.
I felt fine till I came here.
I have some bad news.
Becky grabbed the bottle of good scotch off her bar cart and then joined Cassidy on the couch.
Oh, fuck, Cassidy said. Who's dead?
Becky unscrewed the bottle and refilled Cassidy's glass.
Nobody's dead.
Cassidy let her gooey sandwich sit untouched on her plate.
Whatever it is, just say it, because you're scaring the hell out of me right now. Metropolis is closing, Becky said.
Again? Cassidy exhaled with relief.
Because of the Board of Health? How long will it be this time?
No. I mean, permanently.
Forever.
I don't understand.
The lease is up, and the building got sold to developers. They want to convert it to a mixed-use space, retail and apartments, something like that. Dahlia said something about air rights. I don't even know.
Are you making this shit up right now?
I wish I were.
Cassidy's stomach dropped. There's got to be something we can do.
I don't think so, Becky said. These developers don't want a bar there. They don't want nightlife. They want a live-work environment for people with a lot of money and sticks up their asses. It's kind of amazing the Met has survived this long.
It's just not right. Cassidy leaned forward, put her head in her hands. How soon is this all happening?
End of the month. End of the month?
Cassidy's head shot back up.
This month? Are you kidding?
Eat your sandwich, Becky said. It's getting cold.
Chapter 13. Lying naked in Cassidy's arms felt similar to lying naked in a man's arms, but the feeling of Cassidy's bare skin on Katie's was completely different. It was softer, smoother, and Cassidy smelled cleaner than any man Katie had ever been with. This shouldn't have been surprising, given Cassidy's elaborate grooming rituals. Katie had seen her bathroom products, her body lotions, and facial moisturizers. Of course her skin was soft. Of course she smelled amazing in a way not even the gayest gay man could compete with. Having sex with Cassidy felt similar to having sex with a man, too, but also entirely different. After sliding Katie's pajama bottoms down and off, Cassidy stood at the edge of the bed and undressed herself. Katie watched her unbutton her shirt and throw it to the floor, then pull what looked like a neutral-colored sports bra up and over her head. She let Katie look at her for a few seconds before stepping out of her suit pants. When she climbed back on top of Katie, her gray boxer briefs clinging to her thighs against Katie's own low-rise bikini underwear didn't freak Katie out. It felt familiar. It felt sexy. Katie was hyper-aware of Cassidy's body against her own, the curve of her chest and stomach, the angle of her hip bones. It was Cassidy's hands that Katie lost track of, her confident hands and her warm mouth. It ended faster than she wanted it to. Before she even realized it was happening, she was digging her fingers into Cassidy's back, holding her there for just a moment before pushing her away. Then she lay flat, covering her face.
"Are you okay?"
Cassidy asked. Katie nodded, staring straight up at the ceiling. "I'm not sure how this works," she said. "Am I supposed to do you now?"
"No."
Cassidy wrapped her arm around her.
"Now you just relax."
Cassidy helped her relax by holding her close, grazing her fingers up and down Katie's arm, inducing her into a trance state like a hypnotist dangling a watch before her eyes. It was already the middle of the night when Katie rolled over and Cassidy was gone. She remained still for a few minutes, unsure if Cassidy had left or simply gone to the bathroom. If she heard a flush or running water, Katie decided she would close her eyes and feign sleep, play possum, because snoozing possums never had to account for themselves. They weren't expected to answer questions or have appropriate reactions, or not freak out for the benefit of the same-sex possum they had just hastily mated with. After a few more minutes, Katie sat up, saw Cassidy's clothes were gone from the floor, and then noticed a note on her nightstand. "Sweet dreams. Talk to you tomorrow." Of course they would, but what would Katie say? That she didn't know what to call this? That she wasn't sure if it was a crazy rebound, an uncharacteristic acting out, or a sexual awakening? Or if it was an identity crisis? Or a mistake? "This isn't me," she might say. "This isn't who I am." But did she know who she was when no one was watching? The next morning at work, Katie kept going to the bathroom to check herself in the mirror. Was there a shine to her eyes that gave her away? Did the color in her cheeks betray her? What about her mouth? Did her lips shimmer in a new, wanton way? She brought her face right up to the glass for closer examination, certain that she was somehow broadcasting a change. Because she did feel changed somehow, like she was hiding something unclean, which was of course ridiculous. Why should it matter that Cassidy was female? How outmoded it was to feel guilty.
But when Cassidy texted to say she was stuck working late and their dinner plans would have to get pushed to after-dinner drinks, the knot that had been pulled taut in Katie's stomach came undone. She responded with nonchalance. No problem. I know how it is. Keep me posted. But her physical relief was undeniable. Katie stopped for groceries on her way home and bought ingredients for her mother's lemon-roasted chicken. She craved its familiarity and the smell of comfort it would fill her apartment with. It was one of the first dishes her mother had taught her to prepare, step by step.
"You'll cook this for a boy one day," her mother had told her, "and he'll think you're a knockout because he'll have no clue how easy it is to make."
Of course, Katie had never gotten the chance to dazzle Paul Michael with her roasting skills, because he didn't eat meat, or butter for that matter, but it remained her go-to recipe whenever she needed to self-soothe. Katie squeezed the juice from two lemons like everything was just as it had always been. She removed the giblets and neck from the chicken like her entire life hadn't suddenly come into question. It was done. She and Cassidy had slept together. Katie should have been focusing on what was going to happen next, not existentially, but logistically. Except that sleeping with Cassidy had been like putting on a pair of glasses. It was impossible now to not review all of her previous relationships through this sharper lens. Was she gay now? Had she always been? Did this mean she should go back and revise her memories of past friendships? Reappraise the intensity of her feelings for her former best girlfriends? Maddie in high school. Hannah in college. Amy was never really a best friend, even before she ran off with Katie's fiancé. She only earned that title by default, by being the least insufferable of the crowd that came with Paul Michael. Early on, when Katie sat down to her first brunch with them, they all struck her as something out of a Woody Allen film, which was not a compliment in her mind. Amy was the only one who seemed unpretentious enough to be harmless. Amy wasn't dumb, per se, but she lacked a filter enough to be refreshing. She was the kind of girl who would rather have been the butt of the joke than have no one at the table paying attention to her, which gave Katie an out once in a while. Like when Katie asked their brunch waiter what a bialy was, and the whole table burst out laughing, Amy immediately volunteered that she too wished she knew nothing of the existence of this poor man's bagel that'd give you onion breath all day. Or when Lillian, of Lincoln and Lillian, asked if Kentucky was in the South or the Midwest, Katie gave the most polite answer she could muster through clenched teeth, which was that it was a southern state with Midwestern influences. But it was Amy who broke the tension by saying, "What? How is that possible?" Katie offered its close proximity to Ohio, Illinois, and Indiana as the reason, to which Amy replied, "Kentucky is near Ohio?" Considering it now, this nightmare first brunch with a friend should have sent Katie running, but at the time it gave her an odd sense of comfort. She had sat down at that table feeling like a fish out of water, or rather like a big fish from a small sea that was suddenly a newly self-conscious little fish, encumbered by how rarely she'd left the 300-mile radius of her home state. Meanwhile, these people literally didn't know other states existed. They couldn't find them on a map. To Paul Michael's friends, there was Manhattan, a little bit of Brooklyn, the Hamptons, part of Long Island, and that was basically it. They were no less encumbered by failing to leave their comfort zone than she was. The only difference was that their comfort zone involved bialys. Katie remembered telling herself that this is what she had come to the city for, to expose herself to such foreign mysteries as a Polish breakfast roll. Sure, Paul Michael's group could make her cringe, but she still wanted to know them, to understand them, to learn to laugh with them. And Amy would be her ally. But Katie had never felt a deep closeness to Amy, that feeling of connection and rightness and always wanting to be with this personness that she'd had almost instantly with both Maddie and Hannah. Katie placed the chicken in a roasting pan. She smeared it with butter and herbs, doused it with lemon juice. Maddie had been like the sister Katie yearned for growing up. From the moment she moved in up the street from Katie in 10th grade, they were inseparable. They looked alike, dressed alike. They made each other brave and needed nobody else. Katie had met Hannah when they pledged the same sorority during freshman year at UT. They were fortuitously paired together for quiz night, a tormenting process during which recruits were tested game show style on their sorority's history, the names of national leaders, and important details about all the current members. Katie and Hannah, two natural-born test takers with exceptional memorization skills, were a dream team, blowing their competition out of the water. Their fate was sealed that night. From then on, they were each other's number one and full-fledged sisters for life. Until Katie blew their relationship up, just like she'd done to Maddie a few years earlier. Katie broke into a sweat at the memory of it now, how she was driven crazy when each of them betrayed her trust, her fidelity. When Maddie changed her mind about going to UT with Katie and followed her boyfriend to Ohio State instead. When Hannah abandoned Katie for boyfriend land in the middle of junior year. Katie had refused to forgive either of them. How could she? Even with Justin or Travis or whatever boy happened to be in her life, Katie had still managed to keep her priorities straight. She was utterly loyal to her best girlfriends, and she expected no less in return. Katie sprinkled salt and pepper over the top of the chicken. She began to wonder, did she love them, Maddie and Hannah? In more than just a friendship way? Was that what all the fuss was about? I'm a really good friend, Katie always thought. I put my girlfriends first. If you want to be my lover, you gotta get with my friends. The Katie's bordering on obsessive adoration of Maddie and Hannah must have all along been about wanting more. Katie remembered her logical, constant need of them as almost painful. Agonizing with the possibility that this time maybe they'd get there, that some anonymous expectation would be filled in such quantity and quality that it would be enough. If Katie had loved Maddie and Hannah, did she ever truly love Paul Michael? Her sex life with Paul Michael had always been fine. Sex with boys had always been fine. And not once had Katie felt physically attracted to Maddie or Hannah. Or at least, not that she realized. She just always wanted them near her. Katie cut tiny grooves into the lemons that would be stuffed into the chicken with her chopping knife. It was useful to think of it in this way. If she were playing a game of fuck, marry, kill, Katie would have absolutely chosen to fuck Paul Michael, but marry Maddie or Hannah. Though taking into consideration last night, and the way for days now her body had been behaving like its own animal. Oh, dear Lord. Katie let go of her chopping knife and wiped her brow with the back of her hand. She'd forgotten all about the salacious book still hidden in her couch's seat cushion, and the hot pink boss lady vibrator lying somewhere beneath the couch like a forgotten dog toy. Katie went to the living room and got down on all fours to retrieve both items, then carried them into the bedroom like contraband. The vibrator went into her nightstand drawer, shoved all the way to the back. The book she stood with for a moment, while her mind spun out. If fucking, marrying, and killing Cassidy all at once was a possibility, then she had no idea what to do next. Forget her lemon-roasted chicken. Katie brought the book into bed with her. Studying for a test had always calmed her. It was why she'd always achieved straight A's. Okay, she thought. Let's do this. She switched on her bedside lamp for some proper task lighting and opened the book to Chapter 8, Lesbian Sex, a How-To. The chapter's section headings indicated that she should not skip ahead but start at the beginning. The introduction on techniques and positions, for example, seemed way more approachable than the latter section, fisting safely. Katie was engrossed in the section titled Licking, also known as cunnilingus, when she got a text from Cassidy saying she was still unsure when she could leave work. It was already so late. Who were they kidding? She texted Cassidy back. That's okay. I think I should go to sleep soon anyway. Zzz. But now she was all hot and bothered from the readings she'd done. The obscene bodily feats that she'd spent the last hour imagining, step by X-rated step in her mind's eye. She was relieved to not be seeing Cassidy tonight, but with all these images fresh in her mind, she needed something, some kind of release. Katie considered her nightstand and the vibrator lying dormant inside. This was all too much. She should cook. She should eat. Katie reached over to the nightstand, opened the drawer, and felt around until she had the boss lady in hand. Then she clicked off her bedside lamp. On Wednesday evening, Katie had already closed out all the tabs on her computer and was about to apply her leaving-the-office coat of lipstick when Marion knocked on her door. "The call with Merrill just got moved up to tomorrow morning," Marion said, "so the partners are going to need that draft by sometime tonight." Katie recapped her lipstick. "You're kidding." "I guess we can't really complain. You haven't worked past two in a while." Marion pulled down her eyeglasses from on top of her head onto her weary eyes. She was 37 and didn't look a day under 45 thanks to nights like this. "Your hair just keeps getting longer," she said. Katie stared into Marion's eyeglasses. Guilty as charged. She was still avoiding getting her hair cut because she was still avoiding Vivian. "Yes," Katie said. "It does just keep getting longer. Hair is funny that way." Once Marion was out of earshot, Katie let out a few choice words and then picked up her phone to text Cassidy. Another night would have to go by without their seeing each other. Another night of thwarted efforts. Looking down at her and Cassidy's most recent texts back and forth, Katie considered the possibility that divine intervention was keeping them apart. This was old thinking, and she knew it. The kind her mother and grandmother resorted to in times of frustration. If it rained on their 4th of July picnic, or if there was traffic on I-64 making them late to the Taste of Derby festival, somehow it was always God's will. Katie had long since decided, quietly on her own, that sometimes stuff just happened for no reason. And yet, the thought still haunted her as she texted Cassidy, "So sorry, have to pull an all-nighter." Katie urged her attention back onto her work and reopened all the necessary tabs on her computer. She searched the file labeled Merrill for where she'd left off in her notes and switched on track changes. A thought entered Katie's mind then. A picture, really, or pictures. A multitude of nude, unphotoshopped bodies. Page after page of them. The memory alone made her sort of... wet was such a crass word in this context. Lubricated? Excited, maybe. Beneath her desk, Katie uncrossed and recrossed her legs. She might not get to see Cassidy tonight, but she would still go home to bed and her nightstand. If this was her out, though, having to work late via divine intervention, surely it wasn't God's will for her to go home and cuddle up to the vibrator she'd bought at a sex shop. Old thinking or not, did that seem like something the real Katie Daniels would do? Katie, the good girl, eager to please, obedient daughter. Or, in more recent years, the hard-working, striving-to-fit-in country girl at heart in the big city. None of those labels were 100% right. So who was to say sexually awakened, vibrator-owning, possible lesbian would suit Katie any better? Her phone chimed with a text back from Cassidy. "I understand, but I was really hoping to see you tonight." Then it chimed again with an immediate follow-up. "The Met's closing. It's a total disaster. Could use your moral support." "What?" Katie replied.
Closing for good?
I'm afraid so, Cassidy wrote.
That's terrible, Katie began,
and then paused. She was ultra self-conscious of the ellipses on Cassidy's screen, revealing that she had halted mid-thought, her ambivalence made visible by three little dots.
If by chance I get out earlier than expected, she continued, I'll try to come by.
Try was good. Try was always a safe bet. It gave Katie an out, just in case.
Chapter 14 Metropolis felt like a funeral. Gina was hunched over, elbows on knees, puffing on a cigarette. Becky lingered over a spread of comfort food she'd laid out on the pool table, a tray of baked ziti, garlic bread, and an extra-large serving bowl of Caesar salad. Even Dahlia had come out from behind the bar to just sit with them and drink.
"Go ahead,"
she called out to the gaggle of confused out-of-towners looking to order.
"Leave your money on the bar. Or don't. It doesn't matter anymore."
Off to the side of it all was Cassidy, lounging on her stool, still in her work clothes, shirt sleeves rolled up. Like her friends, she was having trouble grasping the reality of life without Metropolis, but unlike her friends, she was doing it quietly.
"Who are these new owners?" Gina asked. "Who was the old owner?"
"Some guy," Dahlia said. "He's a broker or something. He doesn't even live in New York. Now he sold the building to some other guy who's also a broker or something. It's all just an investment to him."
"Which him is that now?" Becky asked. Dahlia shrugged.
"Both."
Cassidy stayed silent. Nobody was more attached to the Met than she was, which was why her first reaction when she'd woken up this morning was to try to single-handedly rescue the bar herself. She would have liked just about now to lean back on her bar stool and calmly, without fanfare, assert, "I took care of it," to reveal that she'd saved the day by throwing money at the problem, be the hero, accept their thanks but shrug off their praise, say, "It was nothing." But this morning's due diligence had only reinforced the worst. The deal was done, it was done privately, and there was nothing Cassidy could do but accept it.
"Maybe Cassidy can negotiate with the fuckers," Gina said. "Rent out just this space as an investment. Give it to Dahlia to run."
Cassidy looked up. They were all looking at her, eager for her reaction. "Do you have any idea how much this space would rent for?" she said. Their faces all dropped at once. Cassidy did, in fact, know. She also knew how the building would be gutted and rebuilt. How the ground floor would become retail space, one more bullshit store filled with pointlessness, and luxury apartments floating above. But why tell these guys about that now? The pain that came from learning the truth, of her trying and failing, it would be worse somehow if they knew. "Becky," Cassidy said, "you said it yourself. There's no negotiating with these guys. They're set on converting the building to some kind of mixed-use development."
"What the fuck is mixed use?"
Gina flicked her spent cigarette onto the floor.
"Why does everyone keep saying that? What's more mixed use than this?"
She gestured at the room.
"Where else can you find a bigger mix of age and race and class and genders? This is about as mixed use as a place can get. That's the whole point."
Gina patted around her pockets for her pack of cigarettes and pulled out a fresh one.
"We're just not the right mix, I guess, which is bullshit. I say we protest."
"If big bucks over here can't buy our way out of this," Dahlia said, "I don't think a freak parade of us out front holding up signs is going to move the needle much."
Gina lit her cigarette with a match.
"I'll chain myself to the goddamn erotic photo hunt machine if I have to."
"I just can't believe this is it."
Becky reached for a hunk of garlic bread off the pool table spread and bit off its end.
"Every inch of this place holds a memory. Over there was where I slow danced with that girl dressed as Diana Ross after my first pride parade. That was where I was standing when the great beer spitting contest of 2012 broke out.
In that corner there was where I was sitting the night gay marriage was legalized and watched three separate proposals. Remember that, Cassidy?
Cassidy nodded.
Hey, Dahlia.
Gina pointed with her cigarette.
There's an unidentified bodysuit and wearing hottie at the bar looking for the bartender.
Dahlia handed off her glass of whiskey to Cassidy.
Duty calls. I'm calling dibs on striped bodysuit girl,
Becky said. Gina scoffed.
You don't stand a chance with bodysuit girl. She's way too baby got back for your baby back ribs.
Becky squared her shoulders to Gina. She was wearing a t-shirt she'd designed for her butcher shop that featured the slogan, "Come for the tail, stay for the head."
I'll have you know, Becky said. I once shared an intimate moment with a certain well-known fitness guru in the green room of the Today Show.
Gina blew a stream of gray smoke in Becky's direction.
Doug the Pug hardly counts as a fitness guru.
Go ahead and make fun.
Becky tightened the knot on her purple bandana.
But I guarantee that she, who will remain nameless out of respect for the closeted, is coming right to me on her next cheat day.
Becky smiled in bodysuit girl's direction.
And anyway, I met Doug the Pug on Good Morning America.
Earth to Cassidy.
Gina waved her hand in front of Cassidy's eyes.
Care to get in on this bodysuit girl game?
I already called dibs,
Becky screamed out. You can have her, Cassidy said. I'm not interested. Gina picked a fleck of tobacco or baked ziti from her teeth.
Not interested because your goddamn pussy whipped. Not even. Katie whipped is more like it.
Wrong, Cassidy said. I'm not interested because I hooked up with that girl at Cherry Grove last summer.
Becky shrugged her shoulders.
Lucky for me, I've never been opposed to scooping up your sloppy seconds.
Cassidy swallowed down the remaining whiskey in Dahlia's glass and tried to tune everyone out. Becky's words from last night were still rolling around her mind, helping to darken her mood. Becky had been right. There was no stopping time, and there was no sense denying it. Cassidy was aging out of her lifestyle. She and Becky and Dahlia had become the goddamn elders of this bar. Now even that had reached its shelf life. Looking around now at the pockets of girls scattered throughout tonight's murk, a good half of them were familiar, girls Cassidy had either slept with or briefly dated. Some remained friends, others refused to speak her name. None had left a mark. She had cared about each of them enough, enjoyed them while they remained easy and ego-boosting, while they fit effortlessly into her clockwork life without disruption beyond their designated groove. And then she released them when they got complicated. That was all she had to offer. She never pretended otherwise, and she never apologized. She was crystal clear from beginning to end that she wasn't looking for anything more. But then Cassidy had met Katie, and now she couldn't unmeet her. Maybe they'd met just in the nick of time. Maybe meeting Katie was a blessing. Even though Cassidy didn't believe in blessings, or a gift from the god she'd also never believed in, the god who, if he did exist, Cassidy was pretty sure didn't believe in her. Dear Lord, that's what Katie would say to that. She was always letting a dear Lord slip from her lips whenever she was shocked or frustrated by something. The expression should have imparted a sense of fear in Cassidy as a card-carrying heathen, or at the very least, concern. She and Katie never spoke of it, but whether the dear lords were less prayer and more southern verbal tick, Katie must have been raised as a good Christian girl. And that was a lot for Cassidy to be up against. The strict notions of right and wrong, of virtue versus sin, the conformity religion required was more than Katie could be expected to defy. It was all too difficult to undo. Just like Cassidy, in spite of her efforts, could never fully undo the casual traumas of her own upbringing.
She didn't have to be raised with religion to absorb the disapproval of the adults around her. Their notions of what about her was to be encouraged and what should be stifled. Growing up, Cassidy was somehow always bordering on offensive, on problematic. Spoiled is what they called her when she threw tantrums as a child over the baby dolls and jewelry sets she received in lieu of matchbox cars and action figures. Stubborn was what she was when she quit the tennis team over the regulation tennis stress requirement. Now she was selfish, distant, thankless, unwilling to see her parents more than a couple of times a year, even though they lived less than 5 miles away. They loved her, her mother and father, but they would never understand her. Empathy was not a prevailing family trait. Civility, sure. Decorum, yes. Class, always. But Cassidy's parents didn't want to know her better, because deep down, they'd have preferred she were different, that she fit in their world more tolerably. Fine. Cassidy didn't need them anyway. Here in this hotbox of smoke and sweat, filled with bodies just like hers, that defied all categorization, that no label or slur could suitably contain, here Cassidy was home. Here Cassidy didn't only fit, she triumphed. She wasn't merely tolerated, she was desired. The bar did this, Cassidy realized, which was why she'd held it so close for so long. So if Cassidy was aging out of the bar scene, where was she aging to? Toward Katie? She and Katie might as well have been different species. And yet, Cassidy couldn't fend off the surge of affection she felt for Katie every time she let out a dear Lord or bless her heart or some other adorable, if not vaguely religious, thing. Cassidy couldn't talk herself out of the debilitating disappointment she experienced when she read Katie's text canceling tonight's plans. Her own text back oozed neediness. "I understand," Cassidy wrote, "but I was really hoping to see you tonight." And as if that weren't bad enough, she sent the clingiest follow-up text in the history of clingy follow-up texts about the Met closing. "Could use your moral support?" What the hell was that overeager bullshit? Of course, Katie's response was noncommittal. Cassidy wouldn't have wanted to see her own sorry ass tonight, either.
"Yo, check it out! Fight Club! Fight Club!"
Gina jumped up onto her tippy-toes, trying to get a better look across the room. "Wrestling already?" Becky said. "It isn't even one yet." Cassidy followed Gina and Becky's lead and stood up to better see the other end of the bar, where the girls were pushing and shoving. As always, just enough space had cleared around them to give everyone a ringside view. These two had gone at it before. The long-limbed girl with dark hair, who Cassidy believed was Native American, and had some exotic name like Kaya or Mala, and the scrappier short-haired girl everyone called Biscuit. Down they went to the filthy floor, grappling. Cassidy tried to imagine this spectacle through Katie's eyes. How would Cassidy explain it to her, that it was part sport, part revenge? All in good fun, but the bruises were real. That it was as passive as it was aggressive. These two, duking it out, probably loved the same girl, or had gotten hurt by the same girl, and so they tried to hurt each other. Because twisting, squeezing, rolling, punching was somehow less brutal than addressing the real problem head-on with words. It was for the best that Katie wasn't likely to show. Cassidy took a step back and ditched her drink on the pool table. She wasn't even sure she wanted to be standing here right now. It was a fidgety, sleepless night, but Cassidy must have dozed off eventually, because early the next morning she shot up in bed, heart racing in a cold sweat. She looked around her bedroom, took in her surroundings to get a hold of where she was, who she was, what day it was. Had she been dreaming? And if so, when did the dream begin and where did it end?
Her phone was in its rightful place, beside the lamp on her nightstand. She took it in hand and pressed it awake. While she scrolled through the morning news, she continued to take stock. She hadn't brought anyone home. She hadn't gone home with anyone else. She hadn't had sex in or just outside a bar. She hadn't